The history of playing cards is still shrouded in a number of mysteries, but we'll try to outline what may be considered the most recent estimation by those who are concerned with them and by the general historians of playing cards in general. The origin of playing cards is unknown. The probabilities are that these cards originated in the Orient. China makes a pretty strong claim for originality in this particular area, and it is known that they were in use in one way or another among the Chinese for over 1,000 years. In Europe, they did not appear until the early years of the 14th century. And in the course of time, many and unbelievable ramifications have set in. The tarot cards probably have a history separate from that of the ordinary gaming or amusement deck. The Court de Gabalon, one of the first great Egyptologists, favored the theory that these major trumps, as they are called, the 22 major cards of the tarot deck, which consisted of 78 cards, that these were actually based upon symbols used in the initiation rites of the ancient Egyptians. Some have held that they may have been carved upon the walls of the inner sanctuaries of the Egyptian mysteries. Others feel that they may have been freestanding symbols, originally in the form of objects of various shapes, sizes, and proportions, which were used in the instruction of those seeking admission into the sanctuaries. It is also possible, as suggested by Pythagorean lore, that these cards were originally used in a sacred oracular manner. The most permanent and enduring aspect of playing cards, except for gaming, has been the connection between them and oracles. The ancient priests of the tabernacle and the temples of Israel had auricular stones set upon the shoulders of their robes by which they were able to determine the will of deity. More lately from this, the 12 stones of the breastplate of the high priest were believed to have miraculous powers. In other words, what man was always seeking was some way to discover the will of his deities. He really wanted to know what they wanted him to do. But unfortunately, the heavens were silent, and the only link between deity and the laity was the priesthood. The priests, in turn, composed largely of human beings with no extra spiritual powers or faculties, found it very difficult to make major decisions in the lives of people, either for the course of nations or for the fates of individuals. The priests were always consulted, and in almost every instance, they ultimately fell back upon some type of oracle, some way of invoking deity, some way of bridging the interval between the objective and the spiritual causal universe within which we exist. The development of sacred magic related to these issues, and in many instances, as in the Oracle of Delphi, the discovery of the will of deity came through the priestess who served the oracle, who went into a kind of trance and delivered the mysterious quatrains or hexameter verses by which the deities were supposed to answer the questions of mortals. These questions involved many different problems. Problems relating to character, to decision, to career, to marriage, to death, and to destiny, as far as the major purposes of life were concerned. The philosopher Pythagoras was named for the Pythia of the Temple of Delphi. When the child was born, the seeress predicted his future and that which he would accomplish, and it was so. We find many references to oracular revelations in the Bible. Usually, however, they were not in the form of cards or anything of that nature, but they were in the form of some type of psychic link between humanity and the powers governing the world. Primitive magic existed in all parts of the earth, among the most savage and primitive peoples. Always in the last analysis, decision was left to fate, and fate in turn was revealed through the oracles. The oracles stood for the concept that there's a destiny that shapes our ends, and the various efforts to determine the nature of this destiny developed over a long period of time. We are inclined to believe that at the very most remote period, divination was by means of arrows. In other words, small sticks falling in various positions and compositions were held to have sacred meaning. We know that similar sacred meanings were found in China by the use of the so-called oracle bones as early as the second millennium B.C. Oracle bones had inscriptions placed upon the flat bones of animals. These inscriptions were in the form of a question and a built-in type of answer. In the Chinese ideographs, this was comparatively simple. A hot iron was then placed on the reverse side of the bone, causing it to crackle, and the cracklings falling through the inscriptions became the basis of the delineations. We also know that the arrows were perpetuated in China in the form of bamboo tubes with a number of slender rods set in. These rods were shaken out one by one from the tube, and the letter on them was the key to the definition or delineation. Actually, as we proceed further, we begin to come upon another type of divination that was very important, and that was with dice. The ancients had several kinds of dice, both in the Orient and in the Occident. And when they excavated the old streets of Jerusalem and got down to the pavement that was there in Bible days, it was discovered that a number of the stones had board-shaped figures cut into them to be used in playing games of dice or in divination. We know also that according to the New Testament, the lots were cast for the robe of Christ. Lots, then, became the basis of ownership. When you could not decide, naturally, to whom a certain article or condition was intended, no one knew what to do about it. They did not know who was always the one to be guilty or the one to be innocent. So lots were cast, and the decisions were final. Thus, in a sense, the principle of fate was involved with all of the early uses of divinatory articles. If it is true that the Egyptian temples had within them certain magical figures, also the geometrical solids representing the deities, and systems of numbers by means of which oracles were delivered. We can then remember the Wheel of Pythagoras, which, while it may or may not be authentic, is certainly ancient, and by which divination was performed through the combining of letters, particularly the letters of the name of the person asking the question. Always in that period of early study, men turned to the stars for guidance, and the belief of the influence of the planetary bodies upon human life was part of ancient philosophy and still survives under certain persecutions over which it appears to be always victorious. All these little symbols and different articles and different types of things probably led gradually to the production of some type of symbolic card. And one of the earliest names for the tarot cards was the Book of Thoth. Thoth was the Egyptian Hermes. He was the deity that had charge of the books of life. He was the one who spoke for the gods. He was the messenger of the deities. And it was said that he left behind him many books. And it is held by some that the Book of Thoth was really the playing cards, through the constant study and rearrangement of which patterns were created by which human beings could expand their understanding of themselves, their own lives, and the world in which they lived. Actually, then, for the origin of cards, we have three or four choices. One Chinese, one Egyptian, one Hindu, and one European. All of these have been explored, but they all fall back finally to the nature of man himself, and that wherever the human being has existed, he has developed some type of divination, some way of consulting the invisible and discovering, if possible, the will of the gods as it applied to the projects and purposes of his own career. In most countries, and practically all of the areas, the original use of cards was sacred. They were intended to be used as means of communicating with the powers of nature. They were not profane. They were not originally used for gaming. They were used to answer the questions that were close to the hearts and souls of human beings. In the years gone by, for example, when the penitenti order was still flourishing in New Mexico, the ceremony annually included the selection of one of the members of the group to play the part of the Christos in the tragedy of Golgotha. In some of the moradas, or chapels of these orders, the Christos was selected by drawing a card from an old deck. Whoever drew the certain card became the candidate for this role. Now, here is a use of it in the 20th century, which is not so different from what it may have been in Egypt, India, or China. It was the fact that no one wanted to select a person. No individual, even if he wished to be selected, was accepted on this grounds alone. There had to be some kind of a sacred omen, a sacred symbol to indicate this preference. If, as we now suspect, and rather generally, that divination was the original use, then we begin to understand why and how various designs appeared upon these cards. We know, for example, that they are still used, at least underground, in Tibet, where they contain or are marked with the figures and pictures of the divinities and of the sacred objects of Buddhist Tibetan Buddhism. We have a partial deck in our library that was found inside of an image, inside of a large bronze image. This deck undoubtedly was used entirely for religious purposes. It was not for any intent of amusement. It was in order that the divine laws could be communicated in some pattern or way, an instruction bestowed for the improvement of character. Now, this may also have been the old Egyptian form, in which the cards were used perhaps even so far as to determine those entitled to initiation into the sacred rites. So we begin with the use of cards as divinational objects exclusively. Then we find that this is true also of most of the streams of omens or symbols that gradually consolidated in the deck of cards. In the Orient, Persian and Hindu cards are entirely used for religious purposes. Later, they gained other fame, but in India, even to the present time, the deck of playing cards is always a religious object. The most important or most common of these decks is the deck of 10 suits, which contain the cards and symbols of the 10 incarnations of Vishnu. Each of the suits is one of the embodiments of the deity. And the pip cards, or the number cards, are ornamented with a device of that particular embodiment. The first embodiment is the fish embodiment, where at the time of his incarnation, Vishnu took upon himself the form of a fish. And at the time of the great deluge, it was this fish that steered the ark with its people and its animals to the final resting place of security. The last incarnation of Vishnu has not yet come. It is called the Kalki, or White Horse Avatar. In the deck of cards, it shows Vishnu leading a white horse. Each card has suit card has on it one of the avatars, and is accompanied then by a second court card, usually with two horsemen riding in opposite directions. Therefore, unity becomes first manifest as diversity, and a dividing or parting of the ways, as represented by the Pythagorean letter, which we now call Y. The Indian decks are very beautiful because most of them are hand-done. And even today, they differ in minor appearances and even to a minor degree in the artist's capacity to capture the symbolism. But they are circular. They are painted on discs of heavily prepared paper fiber, which has been lacquered and varnished. And they are divided in color according to the suits, but all of them together represent the great cycle of the embodiment of deity. We have very little record that these cards are used in gaming. Of course, it is possible that this has happened everywhere. But except for these cards, we find other cards in India, an exception to these. One of the other interesting decks is a complete zodiacal deck in which the 12 signs of the zodiac become the suits, and the various court cards are represented as deities, usually enthroned upon the symbol of the zodiac over which they preside. This particular system also seems to have been transferred ultimately to Japan, for there we find in the temples of the esoteric sects booklets and small reliquaries with the deity represented and the signs, the sign of the zodiac at his feet. These little relic curios are obtainable. We got several of them in Japan. So the astrological deck was a very interesting one among the Hindus. And it may be noted at this point that complete decks of any of these early cards are virtually unobtainable. They are in a few world museums, because those of artistic quality are usually separated and disposed of separately as miniature paintings. They are very beautifully done. The origin of playing cards in Japan is also rather uncertain. They undoubtedly had indigenous deck types of cards. But when the Portuguese and the Dutch and the Spaniards opened trade there, European decks were introduced. And from that time on, the Japanese created cards similar to the West, but with interesting, curious, and sometimes humorous variations. Wording on these Japanese European cards were wordings were usually misspelled, letters misformed, and the attire of the court cards curiously complicated between Eastern and Western costuming. They also in Japan had a number of indigenous decks, which we find no equivalent to in any other country. One of these decks that is most interesting is the deck of poits, the deck that is used only during the holiday or New Year's season. These decks are doubles, one half having a picture of the poit and the first lines of a poem. The second and matching card has only the remaining lines of the poem. They are shuffled, and in order to select the correct termination to a verse, the players have to be very well versed in literature and in the productions of their various national scholars. In the beginning, these cards were also all hand-painted. They are smaller than our cards and are usually blank on the reverse. These people also had a definite gaming deck consisting of the cards of the flowers and plants ruling the 12 months of the year. Each of these different year cards consisted of a suit of four, showing the various stages in the development of the flower or plant, from the twig to the bud to the blossom to the fruit. These cards are still used very extensively in gaming. The earliest Chinese cards that have come down to us are very much more slender and narrow than our cards, and are marked with various black spots, apparently arising from dominoes. And it is quite possible that there is a strong connection between Chinese cards and dominoes. And there is also quite a possibility between the Hindu cards and the ancient game of chess. There seems to be no doubt that a number of primitive games were combined by various nations in the production of suitable card symbols. The game of chess, for example, was played in India by the Mughal emperors, and the chess board was the courtyard of the palace. And each of the pieces of the set was played by a living person. Various other variations on these difficult and complicated themes can be picked out and have been traced to the best of ability, but the findings are by no means conclusive at the present time. How the various cards of the Near East, possibly Persia or India, reached Europe is again uncertain. Some believe that they were brought back by the Crusaders, whose experiences in the Near East undoubtedly included a study or an acquaintance with the gaming and gambling systems of these countries. Another interesting improvisation lies in the possibility the playing cards were introduced into Europe by the gypsies. The gypsies themselves are mysterious people, and their name includes the word Egypt, gypsy. And it is believed that they may have been remnants of the old Egyptian sacerdotal sects that were driven out by the rise of Christianity. The gypsies became wanderers upon the face of the earth, and they brought with them among their treasures, apparently, a number of elements of soothsaying or prediction and prophecy, psychism and clairvoyance. The gypsies had their own cards, but they also used crystals and palmistry and probably a little hint of astrology mixed into it somewhere. The gypsies wandering about Europe became famous as fortune tellers and were presumed to possess what we now call second sight. Explanations for the second sight also brings in an interesting complication. It is known, of course, that the gypsies became intensely inbred, that they seldom, if ever, married outside of their clan. And in the course of centuries, this inbreeding is believed to have strengthened the psychic propensities, that in some mysterious way, this inbreeding helped to perpetuate a traditional descent of memory, that the individual was closer to the past, to his own background, and to the environments of his ancestors as the result of having more intimate and continuous contact with the bloodstreams of those who had gone before. Regardless of how we want to view this, certainly the gypsies received a very strong support for their mystic arts. As we come down through, we examine certain of the cards, particularly the major trumps of the tarot deck, and these are obtainable now almost anywhere where there is a strong Italian colony. They are still used as gaming cards and for divinational purposes in Italy and in Hungary and in some of the Balkan area. These cards have, however, passed through an interesting modification. As may be realized, the church was dramatically opposed to card playing. It was considered to be a sin not only to gamble, but to use them for divinational purposes. The church wasn't entirely successful, but it did accomplish a few restrictions. One of the most common of these was that during even the 14th and 15th centuries and 16th centuries, apprentices, being apprenticed to a master, had to sign a contract. And this contract included the line that they were not to play cards at all except on the Sabbath after church. There appears to have been, however, a little coercion here between the church and business, because it was feared, apparently, that those engaged in various useful or necessary applications of energy, various vocations, would be less likely to do a good day's work if they could get off in the corner and play cards. So to protect business, industry, ethics, and the church, the use of cards was heavily restricted. Another interesting detail occurs, and that is that in the tarot deck, the second card is called the Papess, or the female pope, and the fifth card is called the pope. Now, there is an old legend that there was once a female pope, which, however, the church is rather reluctant to admit. There is also the fact that on these cards, which were constantly criticized and condemned by the church, there were two sacred figures, both relating directly to Christianity, both wearing the papal tiara, both carrying the papal cross. And as time went on, this got to be an aggravation or an aggrievement of one kind or another. So the modern Italian decks have taken out these two cards and put in their place Jupiter and Juno, two Latin deities. But older decks still have the original allotments, and decks prepared in modern times for students of the tarot, of course, have the original form. But the playing deck, as it is used now by the people, no longer contains these two cards, which are considered objectionable. Gaming was gradually introduced, probably as a result of the natural instinct of the human being to hope for quick gain and to remain steadfast under quick loss. Cards or games were originally probably a combination of gaming and the fulfillment of hope. The individual playing hoped to win. If he won, he considered it a sign of a good destiny. He not only pocketed the money, but had the satisfaction of having gained it through the consent of fate, that it was his by divine right, so to say. The Protestant Reformation practically ended the use of cards in the so-called Protestant areas. But they came back gradually. They were not ousted for long. When the French Revolution overthrew the monarchy, the kings, queens, and jacks of the deck were deprived of their crowns, and all symbols relating to royalty were removed from the French decks. They were, however, gradually replaced. Religious decks in the Western world are not too common, but not too rare. Some decks have the court cards as the prophets and apostles and other biblical figures. A very favorite subject for a king card was Charlemagne. And it is said that one of the queens was derived from the symbolism of Hypatia. All kinds of strange and wonderful thoughts have become associated with these cards. Now, the 22 cards of the major deck of the tarot, which is the one most used by students of the subject, are very much Kabbalized in modern thinking. To the numbers have been added the letters of the Hebrew alphabet, and they have been, the cards have been tied strongly with all of the Hebrew philosophical speculations, including divination. They have been used to reconstruct Kabbalistic designs, and have been used as symbols of the various levels and orders of the Kabbalah. In Kabbalism, the great Sophoretic tree appears in four forms, representing the tree of life on four levels of existence. These four levels of the tree of life are represented by the four suits, and the Godhead is represented by the court cards. The other cards constitute the 10 sephirothic symbols of these 10 spheres or worlds, and also come back again to the Pythagorean tetractys of 10 dots. We'll go into that in a few minutes. Actually, then, the old deck of 78 cards was primarily a philosophical deck. As time went on, a number of improvisations were made. The tarot majors or major cards changed their designs. In some cases, characters from classic mythology and from various systems of symbolism were inserted, and later they became involved more or less with contemporary events. Some decks of cards have famous generals, and one of the prime objects of these successful cards in England. At one time, the prime object was the Duke of Wellington, who honored himself, or was honored, by being placed among the persons of the deck of playing cards. Also with time, educational cards made their appearance. Cards were used to teach astronomy, mathematics, engineering, medicine. They were used to perpetuate literary and philosophical conclusions. They included the quotations from great poets, and they've covered practically every area of human interest, from the most abstract astronomical and cosmological designs to popular baseball and football players. The cards were used in a great many areas, gradually secularized, until the sacred elements or patterns were practically forgotten. The deck of cards that we use today is based upon English decks, and English decks in turn originated in France. The cards, from the beginning of their introduction into England, probably in the 15th or early 16th century, have not varied greatly in design. They have been more or less consistent in the unfoldment of their symbolism. The older cards have a great charm that are more or less missing from the commercialized decks. The older cards were little works of curiosity in themselves. The various cards had interesting and intriguing designs, and the court cards usually represented the various persons' full length and in approximate and appropriate garb. One way of dating the cards in England and France has been the costuming of the earliest known decks. By this, it is assumed that they began by contemporary costuming. In the development of our modern deck of cards as we have it today, a number of other interesting situations came into focus. Originally, the three court cards of the deck were the king, the knight, and the page. The three cards continued in this way for some time, and then with the rise of some feministic movement somewhere, the queen was introduced. Now, the queen was introduced by combining the knight and the page and calling it the knave or the jack, so that that card took the place of two cards, and the queen was inserted, so that it was a deck of king, queen, and jack. Now, maybe more behind this than first meets the eye, inasmuch as the family, the court card family, as represented on the thrones of Europe and throughout the aristocracy, consisted of the father, mother, child. This was the great 47th proposition of Euclid, or rather, more correctly, of Pythagoras, but attributed to Euclid. Therefore, the court cards were transformed into a family. And this family, in early religious thinking, became symbolical of the three persons of the Trinity, so that each of the decks of cards had four suits, and each suit was a Trinity. This trinity of the principles or powers of things extended out and was served by the pip or number cards, of which there were always 10, being the symbol of the tetractus, or the 10 spheres in which the divine trinity operates. The trinities in each case belong to one of the levels of human society, so that by the same way they came to be related to the elements, to the quaternaries in the zodiac. They came to be represented by wherever the three stands out as a holy number or as a symbol of equilibrium. The three was the symbol of harmony. It was the symbol of the home, of the family, and of the cooperation of human beings in the furtherance of the divine plan. The deck was somewhat abridged by dropping out of the major trumps. the major trumps were no longer included, and I think where this change took place, we probably are very close to the time in which gambling or amusement took over and the sacred symbolism gradually faded out. But with the deck of 52 cards, as we have it at the present time, we have some very interesting astronomical factors presenting themselves, and of course these cards can be subjected to almost any type of thoughtfulness to find out what they mean. In the first place, we have 12 court cards. These 12 court cards are recognized as, in an astronomical sense, as representing the 12 months of the year. When the double-headed cards were introduced, each of the 12 cards had two portraits on it instead of one, one inverted to the other. These 12 multiplied or increased by a second 12 became 24. These 24 faces, therefore, fitted very well into the concept of the 24 hours of the day, which in turn descended to us from the 24 elders before the throne in the book of Revelation. Having thus more or less identified this particular point, we go on to the consideration of the cards themselves. Each of the suits consists of 13 cards, and the four suits combined give us 52, which is the number of the weeks in the year. If we add the spots on all the cards together, counting the jack as 11, the queen as 12, and the king as 13, and I'm going up from 1 to 13, the result is 364, which is one day short of the year. In order to take care of this little detail, at quite an old date, the joker was introduced, which made the number of actual spots 365. Some modern card manufacturers, no doubt without any intention of so doing, now provide their decks with two jokers, whereby we take care of leap year. But Milton Pottinger, in one of his studies on symbolism, points out the parallels, for example, between the symbolisms on cards and the symbols of Freemasonry and other ancient esoteric societies. This has, however, certain disadvantages, because if we trace the cards down through the centuries, we find that the many irregularities have stepped in or crept in to change the appearances of the cards. It still remains true, however, that the King of Clubs is probably the grand master of the secret empire of the cards, for he is the only one who carries the orb, which was the symbol of ultimate royalty. But all the cards can be taken, and you can sit down and compare them. You can also, if you're interested, secure different cards from different makers and compare the details of symbolism. Find that in most instances, the major elements of the design are the same.